is the President of the United States declaring on Wikipedia that he is now the President of Venezuela? That's real. And by the way, Donald, why are you the President of Venezuela? Doesn't your oath of office to America have a non-compete? What are we doing?
I have no idea what we're doing. Excellent question, Mr. Stewart.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
I don't.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
It ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me. Jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Oh. Here I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and on dozens of other fine affiliate stations on both the public airwaves and the internet around the country and the world, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com, wondering, yes, what are we even doing here? Welcome to the Bradcast. Glad to have you here with us, no matter what it is we are doing. There is far too much going on today, frankly, for me to do justice to really any of it. But you know, by trying to jam it all in, Desi Doyen, that seems like a bad idea. Just too much.
There is too much. Everything, everywhere, all at once, as usual.
And not to mention, we've got a guest standing by who I am really looking forward to speaking with today. Maybe he can tell us what we're doing here, even if it's about an event that took place years ago. Oh, I'm sorry. I meant it took place just days ago, even if it feels like years ago, in Venezuela, when the U.S. invaded it, killed a bunch of people, abducted their president and his wife, and have in some bizarre place in Donald Trump's twisted mind. He has, we have, the U.S. has, he personally has been running it ever since, even if the same regime is still in place down there, and there seems to be little or no discussion really about any of this anymore, as Trump has turned his attention and ours along with it toward invading other sovereign nations, like apparently Greenland and Iran, not to mention U.S. cities like Minneapolis, where federal ICE thugs have been absolutely brutalizing the population there in a supposed crackdown on illegal immigrants, which has seemingly ended up cracking down, roughing up, detaining, and even killing more legal migrants and U.S. citizens than the so-called worst of the worst undocumented aliens that this Gestapo-like crackdown was supposedly targeting. So I've got just a moment or two for an item or two today before we get to my guest. And then they came for the journalists. FBI agents searched the home of a Washington Post reporter on Wednesday as part of a supposed leak investigation, which the New York Times describes as a significant escalation in the Trump administration's tactics in seeking information from the news media. Well, I should say so. It is exceedingly rare, even in investigations of classified disclosures, the paper reports, for federal agents to search a reporter's home. A 1980 law called the Privacy Protection Act generally bars search warrants for reporters and their work materials unless the reporters themselves are suspected of committing a crime related to those materials, which does not seem to be the case here. But in other words, that law and the First Amendment, at least as we have known it up until now, would allow me, for example, if someone sent me a classified document, it would allow me to publish that document or read it on the air so long as I didn't have a hand in, for example, either stealing that document myself or instructing someone to do so. That would be a crime, but that does not seem to be the case here with this particular journalist. The Washington Post reporter Hannah Natanson had spent the past year covering the Trump administration's effort to fire federal workers and redirect much of the workforce toward enforcing his agenda instead of what they were supposed to be doing. Many of those employees shared their anger with her, their frustrations, their fears with the administration's changes, which she wrote about in a piece at the Post headlined, "I am the Post's federal government whisperer. It has been brutal." It documented more than 1,000 new sources who reached out to her regarding concerns about how Trump was breaking the federal government and its administrative state. In this case, federal officials seized her laptops, a phone, a smartwatch during their search of the journalist Nathanson's home. The Post's executive editor, Matt Murray, in a message to staff, wrote, quote, "This extraordinary, aggressive action is deeply concerning and raises profound questions and concern around the constitutional protections for our work." Now, court documents indicate that law enforcement officials were investigating a federal system administrator in Maryland who has a top secret security clearance, has been accused of gaining access to and taking home classified intelligence reports, all of which is illegal, you know, just like Trump did when he left office the first time and he got indicted for it. But he never went to trial because he became president again instead. The court papers show investigators suspected the man of illegally mishandling classified information about an unidentified country, you know, just like Trump did. Attorney General Pam Bondi said that the search was executed at the request of the Pentagon to look for evidence at the home of a journalist who, quote, was obtaining and reporting classified and illegally leaked information from a Pentagon contractor, which, as I noted, is not on its own a crime. And all of this has led journalism and free speech experts today to condemn the action against otherwise legitimate journalistic activity and what one such expert described as a tremendous escalation in the administration's intrusions into the independence of the press. Of course, we all could have seen it coming. The Justice Department's use of a search warrant to obtain a reporter's material was treated across party lines at the time as a scandal back in 2013 when it involved a reporter from Fox News during the Obama administration. We will see if things have changed in 2026 under Donald Trump. Moreover, as AP notes here, the aggressive posture in this case stands in contrast to the Justice Department's approach to the disclosure of sensitive military information via a Signal chat last spring involving senior Trump administration officials. A reporter was mistakenly added to that chat at the time. As you may recall, Attorney General Bondi back then repeated Trump administration talking points, AP notes, that the highly sensitive information in the chat was not classified, even though current and former U.S. officials have said that the posting of the launch times of aircraft and the times that bombs would be released before those pilots were even in the air would, yes, have been classified material. More on that in the future, I suspect. And one more for now before I get to my guest. Some personnel at a key U.S. military base in Qatar were advised to evacuate by Wednesday evening, according to a U.S. official, and the Gulf country, as Donald Trump threatens possible military action against Iran following the deadly crackdown on protesters there. The decision by U.S. officials to advise folks to evacuate came as senior Iranian officials in Tehran brought up the country's retaliatory attack back in June at Al Udeid Air Base outside of Doha, Qatar, which houses thousands of American service members. It was Iran's that attack was Iran's immediate response to the bombing of alleged nuclear program sites by the U.S. last summer. The U.S. official who spoke to the Associated Press on the condition of anonymity to discuss sensitive plans described the move at the base as a precautionary measure and that other steps were being taken across the region. The official citing the need for operational security, would not go into any further detail, including whether the evacuation was optional or mandatory, whether it affected troops or civilian personnel, or how many were advised to leave. The anti-government demonstrations in nearby Iran began in late December. Hundreds of protesters, possibly thousands of them, have been reported killed since then by the Iranian regime, and Trump has said that he is willing to conduct military operations against Iran if the Tehran government continues to kill and arrest protesters. Because you know how much Donald Trump, you know, stands by protesters exercising their free speech rights against the government, right? Just ask the good people of Minneapolis today. But Trump said on Tuesday that he believes the killing in Iran is, quote, significant. Well, that one is significant. And that his administration would, quote, act accordingly, whatever that means. He noted that he was cutting off the prospect of talks with Iranian officials and told Iranian citizens that, quote, help is on its way, without giving more details. What is that help? What will it be? Well, we're all on pins and needles at this point, but the U.S. military maintains a variety of troops in the region, including at Al Udeid, but the Trump administration shifted some of the resources that it had in the Middle East out to the Caribbean Sea as part of a pressure campaign on now apparently former Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, or whatever it was, or still is, a pressure campaign, a war, who actually knows? And does it matter? Well, apparently so, because now Donald Trump wants to go back to war in the Middle East, it seems, after sending so many of our assets to invade Venezuela. Yeah, what are we doing here, Desi Doyen?
It seems like a bad idea to me to spread the U.S. military thin, but hey, I'm not the president of the United States, so what do I know?
Well, that's because you have no experience and don't know what you're doing. On the other hand, that may apparently be an asset. You might be our next president of the United States. Are you over 35? Don't answer that question. The world's largest aircraft carrier, the USS Gerald Ford, was ordered back in October to sail from the Mediterranean Sea to the Caribbean, along with several destroyers. The carrier USS Nimitz, which helped conduct the June strikes against Iran's nuclear program, they also departed the region in October. The Navy had five small ships, two destroyers, three smaller, faster combat ships in the waters off of Iran as of Tuesday. So what happens next at this point, and whether Trump will attack Iran again, somehow resulting in regime change this time, with thousands of people said to be protesting in the streets and thousands of them being killed? Well, you know, the asking for the type of foreign regime change that Donald Trump hoaxed his supporters into believing that he was opposed to. But now he seems to love in nation after nation. Or, you know, we'll see if he'll be distracted by regime change instead in our NATO ally of Greenland. All of that remains to be seen, even as our takeover of Venezuela still seems to be ongoing, with nobody knowing where any of that may go next. To that end, let's take a quick break here. We will come back with Professor Nicholas Grossman, foreign relations expert, maybe he knows, from the University of Illinois, to try and make sense of what actually happened in Venezuela, why it happened, where it goes from here, and what new nightmares it may end up setting off. That is straight ahead on today's broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
What's What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At The Bradcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Yeah.
What is it good for?
Absolutely
nothing.
Say it again, y'all. Yeah, I don't know what it's good for, but we sure do seem to be getting into a lot of them lately, or at least we will if Trump has his way. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. I know it's been just over a week, which is like a year in Trump era time, but still, just barely over a week ago, the U.S. military, on the orders of Donald Trump, invaded Venezuela, I thought I would remind you. We bombed a whole bunch of places in its capital of Caracas. We killed about 80 people in the bargain, kidnapped its president and his wife, who were then brought back to New York City to stand trial on federal charges for supposed drug running and some sort of weapons charge involving machine guns. With Trump subsequently declaring that the U.S. is now, quote, running Venezuela, or in subsequent statements that he is doing so personally. And just about two or three days ago, he declared on social media that he was the, quote, acting president of Venezuela. Following our unlawful January 3rd invasion of a foreign sovereign nation in direct violation of both U.S. and international laws, not to mention the United Nations founding charter, Trump has also claimed that he, and apparently he personally, not only has full control of the country, but also single-handedly controls all of Venezuela's vast oil reserves, believed to be the largest in the world, which he claims we now own somehow after Venezuela apparently previously stole it from the U.S. in the first place, even though it is under their country. So yes, while it seems forever ago, all of that actually happened and is still happening. Even if we're otherwise distracted by Trump's deployment of U.S. forces against U.S. residents, citizens and non-citizens alike, and detaining, deporting, shooting, killing them, apparently, pretty much as we like, in U.S. cities like Minneapolis, while at the very same time making military threats against Venezuela's neighbor, an American ally, Colombia, as well as our major trading partner, an ally and neighbor of Mexico, longtime political proxy nemesis Cuba, Iran, and, as Trump has been threatening again of late, our NATO ally of Greenland, a quasi-independent territory of Denmark, but on which Trump is now insisting will become a part of the U.S., quote, whether they like it or not. But for the moment, before we completely move on to Trump's next unlawful, unauthorized imperial conquest, I want to focus on Venezuela, which, yes, Trump appears to believe he now owns and has the right to deploy American oil companies to exploit at his will, even if those oil companies do not seem all that eager to play along. Writing in his ARC Digital newsletter last week, just days after our unilateral assault in the Caribbean, in a piece headlined Trump is ensuring that his Venezuela attack has no upside for anyone, University of Illinois professor Nicholas Grossman writes, the United States military captured Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, and while many reactions focus on Maduro himself, that, he says, is mostly beside the point. His government is repressive and illegitimate, having stolen Venezuela's most recent election in 2024, but there are numerous bad governments in the world. The most important question before forcibly removing a foreign head of state is if it will make things better. Grossman goes on to argue, quote, on every stated and possible U.S. goal, this will more likely make things worse. Well, how so? Let's ask the professor. Nicholas Grossman is an expert in international relations and political science at the University of Illinois, where he teaches classes on terrorism, insurgency, national security policy, and 21st century technology and warfare. He's also the senior editor of the ARC Digital Newsletter, where he writes on American foreign policy and national security. Oh, Nicholas Grossman, welcome back to the broadcast, sir.
Hi, great to be back. Great to be with you.
Delighted to have you here. I'm not sure that, and Happy New Year, by the way.
Thank you.
I'm not sure that this will be as much fun as our previous conversation, Nicholas, last summer on Superman. But I guess it still involves truth, justice, and now apparently the American way. So we can go with that. Your column on ARC at ARC Digital was written about 5 days ago. So a lot may have changed in those few short days. But I got a bunch of specific questions based on it that I want to sort of drill down to regarding the oil, why this was done, and the message that it sends to the world. But you argue from the jump that Trump has, quote, botched post-Maduro Venezuela in that he has kept the same Chavista Maduro regime in place. Why was that a mistake, and what would have been our alternative options?
Well, the easy alternative option would have been to not attempt regime change in Venezuela. This is what I meant by there are a lot of bad governments in the world, that this is one of the lessons of, for example, the Iraq War with Saddam Hussein, that Saddam was a bad guy. He had broken a lot of laws. He was repressive. You know, there was nobody that would really make the case, say, for him. But international relations is not a morality play. It's not about one person. And with Saddam in Iraq, he was doing bad things, but it was also a stable situation. He was relatively contained. Mm-hmm. And a similar thing was about Maduro in Venezuela. There were a lot of problems there. Maduro has deserved justice for a long time. And yet, that doesn't mean that removing him will make the situation better for Venezuelans, for the region, for the United States, for the world, for anybody, really.
So really, it wasn't a matter of how he handled Maduro or post-Maduro. It was just the fact that he went in that is arguably not going to ultimately make things better for anybody?
Well, it's both. It's one that it would have been smarter to not do it.
Right.
But then if you're going to do it, then there are a number of other things that could be put into place that would do it better. So I mentioned the comparison to the Iraq War already, mm-hmm. and that had a lot of problems with insufficient U.S. planning for the post-Saddam phase. And that looks incredibly well-planned and very well thought out compared to Trump with Venezuela. That as best as I can tell, there is no plan at all. There's no follow-on U.S. force to do any sort of stabilization mission. There is no cooperation with any regional partner, any U.S. ally. As controversial as the Iraq War was, the United States had over 40 countries that were supporting the U.S. effort. Mm-hmm. Many others, including the U.K., Poland, Denmark, Australia, others provided troops that they sent to Iraq. None of that is present in Venezuela at all. And the Trump regime does not seem to have a sense of whether they want to do regime change or whether they want to do a coup or whether the U.S. is running Venezuela or not. They got rid of the leader and did what's known as, in that case, a decapitation move, but did not do anything to remove the regime that is under him. That mm-hmm. It's not something like, say, with Osama bin Laden running Al-Qaeda, where really is one guy that is leading the organization and has a degree of a cult of personality. In Venezuela, it's a whole government. It's a regime. Mm-hmm. And by removing the top guy, but keeping the defense minister in place and the interior minister does a lot of the repression in place, and the vice president, who was, you know, very much a Maduro person, also all of that in place. The government is there, but without having that stability of somebody at the top.
Now, not to defend Trump here, Lord knows, but to sort of play the devil's advocate, in fact, you note in your own piece that during his first term, the U.S. ran a war game regarding ousting Maduro, and no matter how it happened, coup, popular uprising, or U.S. military intervention, you write, the result was chaos and violence with rival factions vying for power. That said, isn't what we are now seeing arguably the best outcome of all the possible options as you list them? Or are we sort of still waiting for the chaos and violence to to, I guess, get worse down there since we removed Maduro and left his vice president in place to run the country?
Oh, it's the latter. This isn't close to over. It's the sort of thing that, again, to make an Iraq war analogy, reminded me of the photos of George W. Bush under a big mission accomplished banner in 2003, as if the Iraq war was over then, when in a way it was just getting started. And similarly, there was this rush to praise Trump for this operation against Maduro. I just thought it tactically, it was very impressive. You know, it is hard to sneak into a country and kidnap the head of state and then get back out. So, you know, tactically impressive, but not strategically so. And so what we're seeing already in Venezuela, and this was in the 5 days since I wrote this article, but already in Venezuela, we're seeing there have been runs on banks and runs on supermarkets, a number of paramilitaries in the streets. So guys with guns, some of whom are associated with the armed forces and some of whom are not. And it's not totally clear who they are or what they're going to do. So we have not seen any of those competitions for power really get going yet. But that's in part because this was a surprise decapitation. The various factions in Venezuela did not expect Maduro to just disappear overnight. And so therefore, they weren't vying for power in a post-Maduro Venezuela. But they will be now. And that even includes things like internal rivalries within the regime. So where I mentioned the defense minister, the interior minister, they've both been involved with both Maduro and his predecessor, Hugo Chavez. And they have had, you know, some disagreements, and they have different support bases. And so will they continue working together? Will one of them try to become the new Maduro? Will they accept Rodriguez, the vice president, now as the acting president? Will one of them want to try to take it over? Will she have her own ambitions? Is there another person that, you know, we haven't mentioned or really thought of who thinks this is their moment? All of that is up in the air. So we don't know. I guess it is possible to be worse. I can certainly give it that. But the situation is likely to devolve rather than stabilize, or just have a spate of violence, and then at which point the regime restabilizes. But it's unclear why that would be better than where it was with Maduro in charge.
Do you have any sense, Nicholas? Opposition leader Corina Machado, who was barred from running in 2024, but her handpicked candidate, Edmundo Gonzalez, he appears to have won that election that year, subsequently stolen by Maduro, according to a whole bunch of evidence. Shouldn't Trump have tapped her as the new leader? And why didn't he, as far as you can tell?
So in theory, yes. But that would be if the United States was trying to do democratization in Venezuela. And it seems that the Trump administration is not interested in doing that. And so she is a pro-democracy leader. She has been an anti-corruption leader. Trump is largely pro-corruption, and you can see that in many different aspects of things around the world, but including even with the way he's trying to be personally involved with Venezuela's oil industry. She's even really debased herself with, had won a recent Nobel Peace Prize and has said that she would give it to Trump if Trump would just, you know, invade the country and overthrow Maduro. And Trump has said that the direct quote was, she's a very nice lady, is a very nice woman, but she doesn't have the respect, which I think I interpreted as Trump has never shown that much respect for women. He doesn't have respect for things like democracy or rule of law or anti-corruption. Probably also that she did not signal that she and Gonzalez and their team were eager to play ball with the United States to be basically a corrupt U.S. vassal. And I think it's pretty safe to assume that if someone from the Trump administration asked Machado, okay, and so then the United States takes over your oil industry, right? That her reaction would be something like, no, that belongs to the people of Venezuela. And so even though she has more popular support, that doesn't mean that the United States is interested in supporting her, because that's not what the Trump administration is approaching with Venezuela with. But even that being said, where she has, you know, an estimate of what the actual vote in the last election was her candidate won with maybe 60% of the vote, something in that range. But that also does not mean that she would be capable of consolidating power,
right?
That her base of support does not include things like the military and the internal security services. And so that also would be a potential recipe for power competitions, power vacuum, even civil war.
You argue that the U.S. attack on Venezuela has no defensible legal rationale, no international coalition, no occupation force to manage the situation. Has any of that changed since you wrote your piece in the days immediately following the invasion? But you know, an incredibly long, like 5 days or so ago.
No, not at all. And I should stress that there have been some actions that are maybe not legal under international law, but are nevertheless in national interest and that are defensible from arguments based on, say, national security or democratization. And that is also not something that is present here. So yeah. There's really no question about it. The administration isn't even really trying to make a argument for it. U.S. law is clear that to use force under the Constitution, the president either needs permission from Congress or under the War Powers Act of 1973, there needs to be an immediate threat to U.S. national security, some sort of imminent attack that the president has to act quickly to intervene against. And even then, he has to get permission from Congress afterwards to make it legal. And there is no attack on the United States from Venezuela, no attack from any terrorist group that is based there. To the extent that the Trump administration was trying to make an argument along those lines, they focused it on narcotics. I mean, even just the charge against Maduro that he, illegal possession of a machine gun that he's the head of a country. Of course, he was photographed holding a gun now. And when you think of the recent popular trend in Republican Christmas cards of a bunch of people in front of a Christmas tree holding machine guns, then, or I guess, you know, semi-automatic rifles, then it is, I don't know, that one's totally ridiculous. But so the idea that if the U.S. indicts somebody, that is from another country, that then the United States can go and invade any country when it wants to is just ridiculous as a legal argument. Under international law, there's no ambiguity whatsoever of this is basic sovereignty. If you have issues with a foreign head of state, there are various things you can do, but one of them is not cross their borders without their permission and forcibly kidnap somebody.
You cited the U.S. War Powers Act of 1973 last week, I believe it was. Five Republicans, two of them kind of surprisingly, one in Missouri, Josh Hawley, the other Todd Young in Indiana, actually voted in favor of invoking the War Powers Act here to prevent Donald Trump from attacking Venezuela again. The administration has made the argument that, hey, we have no boots on the ground whatsoever. We are not even at war with Venezuela. So there's no reason to have a war powers vote. Are we even at war with Venezuela?
I don't know. I mean, sort of. I guess it depends on how you define at war. The removing Maduro by force is an act of war. That involved a number of U.S. airstrikes against Venezuelan targets. Those are acts of war. That there is not active combat right now, but the U.S. military is likely just starting its intervention in Venezuela. That the ways that this could spin out of control, either where Venezuelan, the new government does not do things that the Trump administration wants, and then that would be potentially more reason to attack, or there's elements of chaos or a power vacuum that is creating more space for drug organizations to operate, a lot more migration, somebody that the U.S. likes even less starting to gain some power somewhere. Who knows? Many of the different possibilities that would then lead to more U.S. intervention. So I don't know if necessarily at war or not, but regardless, that is already a distortion of the War Powers Act of U.S. law. Then when it was written, it's a restriction on presidential power. And the way that it, the law is clear about this, that in the event of some sort of immediate threat that requires immediate intervention so that the president needs to act, you know, we're in the midst of being attacked. He can't go to Congress. He needs to stop it right now. Mm-hmm. That then the president has to get Congress's permission for any deployment within 60 days or automatically must end the military deployment by 90 days. And so it was in Trump's first term that this effectively got changed, where it was with U.S. intervention in Yemen that Saudi Arabia was bombing Yemen and the United States was supporting it, and not just by giving them weapons, but directly with things like mid-air refueling. And so it had gone on for more than 60 days. Congress voted majority in both houses, bipartisan majority, to end the U.S. military activity there. and Trump as president vetoed it. And then it went back to Congress to potentially override the veto. And there were enough loyal MAGA Republicans that they wouldn't do it. And so then the War Powers Act was effectively dead. So the way it's supposed to work is it's automatic. And if the president doesn't get permission, he's not supposed to be able to veto it. If the president doesn't get permission, then the war ends, then the military activity ends. And now it has been effectively changed to Congress has to pass something. They weren't supposed to. The president was supposed to get them to pass permission. So Congress passes something saying don't do it. And then the president can now effectively veto it. And then Congress doesn't override the veto. And so that means the War Powers Act is, if not totally dead, at least defanged. Yeah. And so, unfortunately, I am not especially impressed with the few Republicans in Congress. It is good that they did speak up against Trump. I don't want to say that that's bad. But they did it knowing that there's no real consequences because he'll veto it in a way that Congress had forfeited its power already means that they basically don't have to do anything.
Now, let's talk about the reasons, the supposed reasons. The administration has run through a whole bunch of them for this assault on Venezuela. They claim that they were sending millions of dangerous immigrants here in what they absurdly described as an alien invasion, you mentioned. Then it was that Maduro was corrupt and that it was drug trafficking. And then seemingly revealing that it was all about oil. Trump claims, as you note in your piece, the Venezuela's natural resources were stolen from the U.S. Very quickly, what is he exactly talking about there?
So many things that we hear Trump say tend to be get kind of filtered through his brain, where there is something somewhat real that somebody might have said to him at some point that then comes out oddly. And so to the extent I can figure out what he's talking about here, it was that in the mid-later 20th century, I think 1970s, that Venezuela nationalized its oil industry, and that that meant that some investments that U.S. energy companies had made to develop it, that the government seized control of those and had not, and it's disputed of how much compensation was deserved for that, but at least then that some oil companies in the U.S. feel that they were not fully compensated for that, not sufficiently compensated for that.
Yeah.
And now that's quite different from saying the oil itself belongs to the United States, which there's no standard by which a natural resource inside Venezuela belongs to anybody other than Venezuela.
And he is simply running with that ball that we own that oil. That oil is ours, period. He held a meeting with oil executives at the White House last week. It became apparent that a number of them, most notably ExxonMobil, actually wanted little or nothing to do with going into Venezuela at this time. The Exxon CEO called the nation, quote, uninvestable. Without major changes to its laws and its governing structure, does it even make sense to make the case that Trump did this for oil when the oil CEOs do not seem to be eager to want to go in and get that oil? There's already a glut of oil on the world market, making this kind of development, frankly, unprofitable for them. So does that even make sense as a reason for this to have happened?
It might make sense in his brain that as a potential motivation, you know, it can't be a mind reader, so he might believe it, but it doesn't make sense in the real world. So even if we take all the stuff that the Trump administration has been saying on their own terms, which we shouldn't, because things like drugs are not weapons of war, drug dealers are not terrorists, terrorists are political, drug dealers are doing it for money. A drug overdose is not a foreign military attack. Most of the overdoses in the United States are opiates. What comes out of South America is cocaine. So just all of that is full of lies. But even so, if we take them at their word, that creating a destabilized situation makes it more room for drug dealers, not less. It prompts more migration as opposed to reduce it. It's going to make more people flee. And even on the terms of oil, it doesn't make sense because the oil that is in the ground in Venezuela, including some that's offshore also, is dirty. It's what they call in the oil industry sour, meaning it needs a lot of refinement. The stuff that is in like Texas or Oklahoma or Saudi Arabia is almost ready to go when you take it out of the ground. And so you can sell it. You have to refine it a bit, but then, you know, sell it right away. The stuff in Venezuela takes a lot of refinement. It wouldn't be profitable at the current oil price, and that is before how much it would take to upgrade Venezuela's oil industry, the infrastructure, to get it on par for the U.S. companies. We're talking well over $100 billion and years of work. And on top of that, the biggest concern, I would think of as an oil company, as an oil investor, the biggest concern there would be the security. Oil infrastructure is large. Oil catches on fire. It's something where you can't really do it if there is a active insurgent movement or if there is a hostile local government. Mm-hmm. It's something that no oil company would be willing to risk tons of money in some big investment that then some dissident group blows up with a few drones. And so we need to have some sort of security situation. And this is where the lack of any sort of follow-on plan of any occupation or stabilization force or international partnerships or really plan for anything creates such a big problem, because there's not a reliable security situation there, especially not long-term. There's not reliable rule of law there. So any oil company potentially putting in infrastructure, maybe the politics changes and the government seizes that. They don't know, so they're not going to take the risk. And so if Trump did, in fact, go in to try to take oil from Venezuela, and it really looks like that's what it was, because at least that's what he keeps on saying over and over again, that in that case, it also doesn't make any sense, because U.S. companies aren't going to do it because they're not going to profit from it. And they don't need the oil there either, because U.S. refineries are getting everything they need from Canada, Mexico, and the United States. And the U.S. is, at this point, a big oil exporter. Mm-hmm. So they're not looking to try to get a bunch more. It doesn't even make sense on those terms.
You're right. And there was a day or so last week when he was bragging that the Venezuela is going to give us 30 to 50 million barrels of oil, which really is about 2.5 days worth at the high end of oil here in the U.S. for what we consume every day. So that's not much of a prize. But if it's not about oil, if there's no legal rationale for any of this, if there's no support from international partners, as you ask in your piece, what is the point of behaving like high-tech pirates beyond theatrics? Well, I want to hear from you, Professor Grossman, what you believe is the point. But I want to share my argument as I've seen this as it's happened. I want to get your thoughts on it. I think that, and I'm not an international relations expert like yourself, but it feels like to me, the point is actually twofold. One, Trump has been angry since the courts blocked him from using the Alien Enemies Act for his mass deportation of Venezuelan immigrants, and because the AEA requires that, you know, we actually be at war and or invaded by a country before that can be invoked. And that simply was never the case with Venezuela. So he's sort of trying to make that the case ever since then. That's one reason why I think he got on this path. And two, in truth, it seems like it's nothing more than a naked show of power to show that he can do this, so he will do this, and in the bargain set the example that he can do it anywhere, anytime that he wants, and that, as we've seen, there's really nobody who can or is willing to stop him. So, you know, with 11 days or so of hindsight, I guess, what do you think of those theories? And otherwise, what do you see as the point of this unlawful international piracy?
So I think I lean towards the second one quite a bit. You know, it doesn't need to be only one reason. It's many mm-hmm. things possibly mm-hmm. at once.
Yeah.
And there could be some sort of bank shot with migration or with deportations that, you know, I can see someone in the administration, like, say, Stephen Miller making that argument.
Yeah.
That being a reason why he would support it. But a lot of it, I do think, is as demonstration of power because they can. Many of the other things that when we've been arguing about why this would be negative, it would be negative for United States national interests or for U.S. allies' interests. And nothing Trump has and his administration have done have seemed to act that way, that, or at least to conceive of national interest in the same standard way that presidents, various leaders, voters, even of both parties, had in the United States for many years. Mm-hmm. That so there's, you know, because I can, because then people be more afraid of me, because people be more likely to pay me off. I mean, the one other reason that you didn't mention, but I don't have concrete evidence of this, so this is more speculation, but I get a distinct whiff of Marco Rubio in all this. And Rubio is the Secretary of State and the National Security Advisor, is the only American in history to hold those positions, both of those positions at once, besides Henry Kissinger.
Yeah.
And after Kissinger had both, the broad consensus was that should not be just one person ever again. And Rubio has a few other jobs too. But Rubio has had issues with Venezuela for a while. He also, in particular, has had strong issues with the government of Cuba and with the repressive, you know, dictatorial government of Cuba and with Venezuela's support for it. So Rubio has put up with a whole lot of things that most people would consider humiliating to be in this position, and continues to do so on a regular basis. And he is likely maybe not the only one, but a driving force behind the United States being more aggressively interventionist in Latin America. And in part, I think, has designs on overthrowing the government of Cuba.
I wish you hadn't started that with a whiff of Marco Rubio, because I can't seem to get that out of my mind at this point. But in the conclusion of your piece, you argue somewhat surprisingly, in part, actually, unless I misunderstand it, but you write, quote, the U.S. removing Maduro won't give international aggressors the idea to target foreign heads of state. Russia has been trying and failing to kill Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky for years, but the military action, along with imperialist threats against Greenland and others, shows that the U.S. under Trump supports aggression rather than opposes it, creating more cracks in what used to be the U.S.-led liberal world order. But on the argument that this, quote, won't give international aggressors the idea to target foreign heads of state, why not? Why wouldn't it? Doesn't it offer a very specific, you know, permission structure to do so even without any declared reason? I mean, Russia can say, look, see what we're doing in Ukraine. It's the same thing that the U.S. did. So can China in Taiwan, et cetera? No? Am I misinterpreting your argument there?
No. You're interpreting it correctly. It's just that they already thought that stuff. So, you know, meaning, and that's why I use Zelensky as the example of it, that Russia has been hoping, trying, dreaming, scheming in many different ways to try to pull off against Ukraine what the United States did against Venezuela. And might be also kicking themselves that they didn't do that or something like that as an opening move. Mm-hmm. And so that wasn't new for them. And they have done, Russia in particular, has done things like assassinations, including with exotic poisons, like with a radioactive poison that is made in Russia, you know, doing those sort of things because they want people to know you. If you don't want people to know who it was, you make it look like an accident. Mm-hmm. If you do it with this special poison that's only made in Russia, it's because, you know, they want everybody to know. But the part where I do think where I agree with you, I think you're onto something, is that the mechanism is countries might have hesitated to do that, thinking that it would get a negative reaction from the United States and therefore was not worth it. That, you know, is the sort of thing where the direct action against a foreign head of state is so clearly against international law and well-established international norms that it was one of those lines where, of course, the United States has not always been positive in the world, you know, with the obviously a mixed record there. But in general, with the United States standing with on the side of the world's democracies on things like values of freedom and laws and mutually agreeable trade and those, the U.S. has, you know, this is the conception of leader of the free world. As long as the United States was doing that, and did to the extent the U.S. did for many years, that meant that potentially aggressive authoritarians, or really aggressive anybody, would think twice before they would go down a path like that, because they would think that the doing that, even if, you know, maybe the U.S. Would be hypocritical about it, doesn't matter. If the U.S. is going to react negatively, then it is not worth it for them.
Right.
And some actions had worked to establish this, with the first Gulf War probably being the best example of 1990s, Saddam Hussein's Iraq invades Kuwait. This is post-Cold War. This is just such a clear case of international aggression, the clearest case of somebody just trying to take land as a matter of conquest, take it by force, in the clearest one before the Ukraine War. So with Russia doing that to Ukraine, you have to go all the way back to 1990 for somebody else to do something like that. But when Iraq did that, a massive international coalition led by the United States mm-hmm. pushed Iraq out of Kuwait, restored Kuwaiti sovereignty, and that upheld the international system. And countries have been wary of taking action like that, potentially with Russia and various former Soviet countries. You mentioned China and Taiwan, many other possibilities, but where they have been wary of targeting heads of state, that they would target leaders of terrorist groups, as the United States did, as Israel did, for example, but did not target leaders of governments. Those were thought of as off limits, and that made the world more stable. So with the United States now effectively announcing that the United States is not going to look on this stuff unfavorably, and there's no risk to you of any sort of negative U.S. reaction. In fact, maybe the president of the U.S. might kind of like it or respect you more, or think, oh, you're more like me in that regard. That makes the world more dangerous by getting rid of that disincentive for countries to try it.
Yeah, and finally, and relatedly, I think, speaking of other nations and international aggression, I mentioned at the top, new threats now by the U.S. against Iran, newly ramped up threats, I guess, vows, in fact, to somehow take over Greenland at this point. Doesn't the action in Venezuela, and evidently the lack of action by the nations of the world and by the U.N. and their apparent lack of ability to do anything, and I mean anything about it, doesn't that offer a blatant permission structure, not just for other nations, but more specifically here for Trump himself to simply do this again and again and again in Greenland, Iran, Colombia, Mexico, Cuba, etc.? In other words, Nicholas, which of them will we be talking to you about next when you join us next time on the show?
So the answer to your question is yes. And I mean, I think the specific one is probably Greenland. And that is the one that the Trump administration has been fixated on. So a lot of people really underestimated for years, really underestimated American power. And in part, I think a lot of America's critics, because they were focused on the things that America was doing that they didn't like, missed how much the United States acted with restraint, in that we have not seen a world's most powerful country do things the way that the United States acted in, especially, say, the post-Cold War period, that with things of voluntary, and this you can go all the way back to World War II, of voluntary alliances like NATO as opposed to armed conquest and occupation, or trade rules that, yeah, benefit the United States a little more, but make everybody rich, that they're not like the colonial relationships of exploitation, for example. What that means, though, is when actors like, say, Russia would break those international rules, the reason why somebody did something about it was because the world's most powerful country, the United States, did something about it. Otherwise, countries would largely be too afraid to make too much of an issue for it, which is very reasonable, being a smaller country, that you don't want to pick too many fights with countries that are bigger than you. It causes a lot of problems, even if you are totally in the right when you did so. And so the U.S., we did see some of when the United States is determined to do something, the world can't do anything about it, with the Iraq War, where the U.N. did not give the United States permission to do it, and yet the U.S. did it anyway. But we have not seen the U.S. act without cause in the way that the U.S. did with Venezuela, without allies, without any of that other support. And we're seeing that there weren't consequences, or at least not immediate consequences, that other countries' criticism was muted because their criticism wouldn't really do anything about it, except for potentially create various tensions with the Trump administration that would be an additional headache for them. So it wasn't in their interest to really do anything about it, besides maybe some muted criticism here and there, or by places that are already on the Trump administration's bad side. I think that you're right in that what it seems the biggest effect seems to be that it has emboldened him and emboldened actors such as Pete Hegseth, of where they don't think that anybody can stop them and that they certainly don't care about violating the norms or about the long-term risks of upsetting the international order. And so there's some element that feels maybe a bit like Trump has been jealous of Putin in particular, and maybe Xi and some others, of getting to have these spheres of influence or to try to bully neighbors. And the threats against Greenland, if anything, and this it's hard to do, but make even less sense than the arguments against Venezuela, because Trump has been saying things like the United States needs it for national security, and the U.S. already has full access to Greenland for national security. There's been a U.S. base there since 1950s. Denmark is in NATO. Denmark is among the countries that sent troops to Afghanistan with the U.S. after 9/11. In fact, they had the highest per capita casualty ratio of any U.S. ally in Afghanistan. And that was only because the U.S. was attacked, but not because Denmark was attacked. So the U.S. already has access to it. claims that this needs to be done for Arctic security, when in fact the U.S. is already doing a lot of Arctic security. And the best way for the U.S. to do Arctic security is with all the northern allies that are in NATO, such as Canada and the Scandinavian countries, including Denmark. Has also said, Trump has claimed that, you know, Russia or China could just take it and there are these Russian and Chinese ships there, which is just straight up a lie. They are not there. It would be extremely difficult for them to take it. And they're not even trying to take it. Yep. And if they were trying to take it, it would be much harder for them if they had to face all of NATO rather than if they had to try to face the United States alone.
Correct. And by the way, he said the very same thing about Venezuela. Well, if we don't go in there and take it, China and Russia will.
Yeah, and that's just, I don't know what else to say there. I mean, that's just a lie. It does not make sense. It does not comport with reality. And so then it's, you know, an excuse, because I think at some level it seems like he and a lot of his team has realized that if you just say the words national security, that they'll get more deference. You know, that there are, for example, some judges, some including some on the Supreme Court, who will react with like, yeah. Oh, well, if it's national security, you have to defer to the president.
Yeah.
And no mechanism for that, making that actually be something that is connected to reality.
Well, I got to say, I really, really hope you're wrong regarding Greenland, because I think if we turn against a NATO ally like that, that's pretty much the end of the post-World War II world order at that point, really. I don't even know where we go from there. I hope you're wrong. I fear you're not. But I fear it might be our next conversation with you on the broadcast. Nicholas Grossman is the international relations professor and political scientist at the University of Illinois. You can read his work at Arc Digital. He is grossman.arcdigital.media. Sign up for his newsletter there. And you can follow him on the Blue Skies at Nicholas Grossman. Always a delight speaking with you, sir. I only sort of look forward to doing it again soon.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Brad. And I know when bad stuff happens in the world, that's when I'm more interesting to talk to. So hopefully I don't talk to you again, but I think it'll happen.
I really enjoyed that Superman conversation. We'll try to find a similar excuse for the next summer blockbuster. Thanks, Nicholas. Okay, we got to get out. Thanks as well to our producer, Desi Doyen.
Yes.
Thank you very much, Desiree. Boy, that was a troubling conversation, wasn't it?
Yes,
anyway,
yes, it was.
Thanks to
but
all.
But hey, more information is better, right?
Sure, we'll go with that. thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program, you can download it anytime for free at bradblog.com, where all we ask, we request, is that you hit a donate button while you're there to help us stay on your public airwaves. You can go straight to bradblog.com/donate if you like, to make that quick, easy, and painless. Drop me email. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the social medias, you will find me at TheBradBlog. See you there. Until we see you here next time, hopefully tomorrow with Digby and Driftglass, I think.
Yep.
Until then, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener-supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.